Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. It's easy to overlook everyday miracles like running water. I don't usually think about where my water comes from or what it takes to get it to my house. I'm oblivious to the lifeline of pipes underneath my feet. But for people living in Philadelphia some 200 years ago, running water was a novelty, a marvel, a feat of engineering. Philadelphia was the first major city in the U.S. to construct a public water system, which made quite the splash. Fairmount Waterworks, a grand palatial construction on the banks of the Schuylkill River.
It really was comparable to, I guess, Niagara Falls in terms of a tourist attraction. So people would come, see the water wheels turning, listen to the water, and just really be in amazement. It really was a tourist attraction.
That's Dionne Watts-Williams. She works at Fairmount Waterworks. These days, it's an interactive museum and event space. But in its heyday, visitors could see the water flow through the building. The water pipes were originally made out of hollowed-out logs. A system of steam engines pumped water up more than 90 feet to a reservoir.
So if you could imagine a water wheel pushing water uphill and then gravity taking hold to provide water to businesses and homes, that was really ahead of its time for the 1800s. That was like really unheard of.
Fairmount Waterworks had lots of issues and problems. It stopped operation in 1909, but its golden age was defined by the desire to provide clean, safe water to residents, something that remains a challenge to this day and is becoming more difficult in so many places because of drought, climate change, and sprawling development. On today's episode, where our water comes from and the challenges threatening the water supply. Water is becoming a precious commodity in many places. The American West is experiencing what's now being called a mega drought, and the dry conditions are quickly draining important water supplies. One ranching community in Wyoming is trying to find ways to protect their main water source. Part of the problem is that water law hasn't kept up with emerging science. Melody Edwards reports.
I headed down the interstate across southeast Wyoming, where, as far as the eye can see, was yellow prairie, until I arrive at Alan Kirkbride's ranch. Here, it's a lush oasis, thanks to the creek flowing through. As soon as I arrive, Alan took me out to his ATV to see where this creek originates as groundwater seeping out of the ground. We followed the spring to where it flowed into Horse Creek.
Now you see, these are coyote willows here, aren't they? Taller trees, then you've got river willows, all those down by my house on Sprager. And then you've got some box elders that are taller. All pretty much natives, those guys.
Here, the stream goes wide and flat, thanks to beaver dams that slow down the water flow, creating even more wetlands. Alan said Horse Creek is the last remaining free-flowing stream in Laramie County. Groundwater drilling for agriculture has dried up all the rest. But now he's afraid even Horse Creek's days are numbered.
We talk about people fighting over water, that they've been doing it for 100 years. Well, we see the future is very possible. Continual difficulties between different users. It's in our future, I guess.
It's already happening right now. A big fight has pit neighbor against neighbor. At the heart of this dispute is access to the water in the Ogallala Aquifer, an immense underground sea that stretches from Oklahoma and Texas north across the Great Plains to the Rocky Mountains. Alan and his neighbors want to stop more drilling into the aquifer because they say it threatens their springs and wells. Reba Epler is a water attorney, and her family's ranch is also potentially affected. She remembers when her dad found out what one of their neighbors was planning to do.
My dad noticed those ads in the paper, because they have to notice those. And he was like, this is crazy. 8 wells?
Their neighbors, the Lurwick family, had applied to drill 8 high-capacity water wells into the Ogallala Aquifer under southeast Wyoming. They said they needed it to irrigate their crops, but the amount of water they were asking for was enough to cover 4,700 acres with a foot of water, 1.5 billion gallons.
And that's enough to water 13,000 people a year, and their lawns.
Reba's dad and the other neighbors knew what this could mean for the creeks and springs and wells they rely on. They'd heard about places in other states where the Ogallala Aquifer had been drained down.
Look what's happened in western Kansas and eastern New Mexico. Those towns are, they're like on the brink of having to just move because they've taken all their groundwater. That could happen here very easily.
So Reba, her dad, and 16 other ranchers banded together to fight the application to drill the 8 wells. Reba represented them in court.
I assert to you that this creek, this stretch of the creek, is the last running creek in Laramie County. The rest of the creeks have been harmed so detrimentally that they have passed their ecological threshold.
There were also questions about this massive need for water. Jim Pike is the retired district conservationist for Laramie County, where Reba and all her clients ranch. He helped ranchers come up with a way to seriously reduce their water usage.
And so I was surprised when the state engineer then issued an order to allow for some high-capacity wells for people to apply for them. And I think it was probably in response to some of the larger oil companies that had moved into Laramie County and needed water.
Needed water for their fracking process in drilling for natural gas. This all raises an uncomfortably squishy question. Was the Lurwick family applying for these permits so they could irrigate crops, as they said, or so they could sell the water to energy companies? Because if so, there's a word for that. Speculation. Saying you need water for one thing, and then hoarding it to use for something else. But the Lurwicks insisted the water was for crops. Here's their lawyer, William Heiser.
The proposed use in this situation is irrigation. That's what we're asking for in this situation. To say that irrigation is not a beneficial use, I think flies in the face of the statute.
But when a member of the Lurwick family was pressed in court on whether he would transfer the use of water from irrigation to oil and gas development, he said, quote, possibly, but not likely. That word possibly set his neighbors' teeth on edge. But speculation, saying you need water for one use and then using it for something else, isn't technically illegal in Wyoming. And attorney William Heiser argued that the courtroom wasn't the place to debate policy.
This forum is not the place to challenge those rules. That's down the hall and up the stairs. If you want to change the rules, if you want to change the law in the state of Wyoming, that's where you need to go, not here.
Down the hall and up the stairs is the Wyoming legislature. Ann McKinnon is the author of the book Public Waters, Lessons from Wyoming for the American West. She says the state of Wyoming has become more reluctant to change its water laws over the years, maybe because it's here that Western water law was originally developed, including the very idea of public waters, that water belongs to us all, and how it's used must benefit us all.
Wyoming people, very justifiably, are very proud of their water law system. It was an important system and a sort of a key system that others followed in the 1890s. But people often tend to also think that it is practically tablets written in stone.
Ann says with the onset of climate change, those stone tablets may need some revising.
One of the great strengths of Wyoming water law is that it has changed over time to accommodate the needs of our society in this particular place as that society has changed over 130 years, and that it will need to keep on changing.
Scientists say in the next 50 years, the Ogallala Aquifer is expected to be depleted by 70%. A lot of people, including policymakers, have the wrong idea about groundwater that collects in aquifers. They think it's separate from surface water, like rain, or water in streams, when really, it's all part of the same system.
They're basically the same thing.
That's Olivia Miller, a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Utah.
Water, whether it's snow or rain, falls on the land surface. Some of it runs off into streams, and some of it seeps through soils and then enters aquifers, you know, in the subsurface.
Olivia says people also seem to think that groundwater is safe from the evaporation caused by climate change, but that's incorrect.
Groundwater is vulnerable to climate change because the whole water cycle is so closely linked to the climate system. The water cycle, it's that precipitation and temperature that is our climate system.
Olivia says in the West, people tend to think of groundwater as an unlimited resource.
People turn to groundwater more, so they use it more. But it's sort of like your savings account where you put a little bit in at a time, and then you kind of can draw on it when you need to. But if you just start to rely on that, it'll eventually run out.
But right now, water law in the West doesn't reflect this science. Reba, the attorney representing the ranchers, wants to change that.
First of all, the water law needs to recognize that the groundwater and the surface water are one. We have to stop looking at this as if it's somehow two different things. Somehow that became the thought in Wyoming, and it's just not true. There's no science to support that thought.
She also wants lawmakers to make speculation illegal so people can't hoard water for future uses they aren't honest about, and to set a minimum base flow to protect streams. And Reba's not just dreaming, she's acting. In this year's legislative session, she and Alan and their neighbors went down the hall and up the stairs and proposed a bill to lawmakers that would make the guy applying for a water well responsible for proving it wouldn't hurt his neighbors. Right now, it's the people who are trying to stop the drilling who are paying for lawyers and experts to prove these wells will drain their creeks. Alan Kirkbride, the rancher we heard from earlier, had been especially proactive. He sat before lawmakers and made his case.
The request is, we felt, it's so excessive, we just had to respond and contest it.
Thanks to Alan and the other ranchers, Wyoming lawmakers did pass that law, putting the burden of proof on applicants to show their wells wouldn't injure other water users. But Alan didn't live to see it signed into law. At 73, he died in his sleep, reading a book on geology just days before the final vote. Reba says the stress from this case might have been too much. Reba says Alan will be sorely missed.
He did the work of 10 men, so we're really going to need a lot of people to step up in his place.
But the passage of the bill did not slow down the Lurwick's applications for those high-capacity wells. The state engineer has continued moving forward to grant them. Reba says this case in southeast Wyoming should serve as a warning across the West as droughts and aquifer depletion worsen.
They want to go in that direction of unbridled rape and extraction of our resources. That's where we're going with all this. We can't allow that. I mean, as a society.
And Reba plans to keep fighting to protect her beloved creeks and the aquifer supplying them with water all the way to the Supreme Court.
That was Melody Edwards, host and producer of the Modern West podcast from PRX and Wyoming Public Media. The new season, The Great Individualist, is all about ranching and how it's evolving.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about water and where that resource comes from. The vast majority of Americans get their water from a public utility. You pay a water bill and the faucets flow. But about 13% of Americans, millions of households, get their water from private wells, tapping into water underneath their property. Reporter Jad Slayman talked to a Washington State environmental scientist who's been in charge of his water supply for decades, and he wants to teach others how to filter their own.
David Tarsi has spent most of his life in the forests of Washington State. It means he can step out of his front door and see nothing man-made, only trees and sky.
We have a large lot here, about 6 acres. It's been untouched for about 100 years, so the trees are huge, and we have just left it except for where the house is.
It's the type of place you won't find unless you're looking for it.
There is a driveway that most people won't drive down because it looks like it doesn't go anywhere. That's our driveway. It's about 300 feet long. Then there's another driveway that hooks to that driveway that's about a quarter of a mile long.
Living out here also means less of the man-made world reaches him. He's got internet and electricity. That's how we spoke. But for water, he's on his own. Most of it comes from his own private well.
Basically, if we didn't know we had a well, we wouldn't realize it, because it's just like if you're in the city and you turn on your water, it's the same thing. But you can hear the well pump kicking in, though.
And then there's the taste. David's water tastes different.
Sweet. It's got a little bit of iron in it, not much. It has, let me put it this way. When I say what it tastes like, when I go somewhere and I drink chlorinated water, it makes me gag. That's how good the water is here.
David's so used to his water that he actually fills up a water bottle and takes it with him if he goes into town, telling waiters with full pitchers, thanks but no thanks, at restaurants. By chlorinated water, he means what you and I probably drink, those of us who get our water from a large public utility. A lot of it is chemically treated to make it safe to drink. David's water, on the other hand, is purified by geology.
The filtering occurs as the water seeps through that compact glacial till. It's like a great big giant massive carbon filter, basically. So by the time it gets down 130 feet, it is totally filtered.
Glacial till is basically broken up rock and soil deposited long ago by a glacier. 130 feet down is how deep David's well goes. He had to have it dug in the 70s when he moved in because he was the only one out here. No city or county was going to lay a pipe deep into the woods just for him. He called a well digger who had water maps of the area where surveyors thought you'd find groundwater. David lucked out. Records showed he'd find water at about 100 feet down. If he would have built his place in the next lot over, he would have found nothing.
They have a truck that comes in with a great big thing that looks like a pile driver, and it has a motor that lifts this way. It's like a giant drill. It lifts up and it comes down and it slams into the ground and it just keeps banging and banging and it pushes it down. And then he has a pipe. And as he drills down, he has another driver that drives that pipe down. So what we basically have is a pipe in the ground, a cast iron pipe that's about 130 feet long and it's driven into the ground.
The well digger explained to David the different layers beneath his property.
What we have here is called compact glacial till. Basically, it's kind of sandstone that's not really hard. He said that goes down about 20 feet. And then he said there's a little bit of gravel and then there's more of it. And then below that, there's layers of gravel. During the Ice Age, the glaciers were here and they were about 1,000 to 1,200 feet deep here. And they just ground away. And so what we have here is compact glacial till, and the water soaks through that very slowly.
It's that water soaking in this gravelly layer of earth that David drinks. It takes 7 years for water that falls as rain to make it all the way down there. David dug another shallower well some years later for extra water, but that one only goes down 10 feet. If there's drought or pollution, David's water supply is directly affected. The deep 7-year well, not that much. It can kind of roll with the punches, but the shallower one gets dry or dirty much more easily.
And it's the only way we would really use that for anything else would be to run it through a slow sand filter, which I actually did. I built 2 slow sand filters and I run it through those and that goes into the cistern and that's the water that's in the cistern.
Slow sand filters purify water in ways that mimic the way nature does. David learned about them in the early 2000s when he went back to school to study environmental science. The timing was lucky, as regulations around wells have tightened year after year.
But the water it's critical here now. It's really critical. A well is almost impossible to get here now. You have to file a request with the EPA here in Washington, and they may grant you a permit, and they may not, depending on the water.
If you can't get water out of the ground, well, you can still get it from the sky. Rainwater. But even here, there's a weird state government catch.
So some states do say it's legal. It's legal to harvest the water, but you can only harvest the water that comes off your roof.
The reasons for that are pretty arbitrary, it turns out.
Yeah, it's I try to avoid getting upset about it because it seems so strange.
David's been running a water harvesting blog for years that tracks the strange legal history of who the rain belongs to. One man in Oregon actually did jail time for building an artificial reservoir on his land that collected rain the state said didn't belong to him. Since about 2009, harvesting rainwater is legal in every state. But in a lot of places, you only have a right to the water that hits your roof and trickles off of it, which David understands is some kind of holdover from archaic water laws passed when the American West was still being settled. When water was so scarce, it led to real conflicts between ranchers and farmers and everyone else. At this point, he looks at it like a grant me the serenity type of thing.
It's going to rain, it's going to go into the ground, and you're going to get it eventually. If I store it and use it, I'm going to water my garden with it. It's going into the water, it's going into the ground, and you're going to get it anyway.
The sand filters he uses for rainwater are deceptively simple, essentially just barrels of sand and rocks.
Not much less than 2 feet deep. A 55-gallon plastic barrel is perfect. And in the bottom of the barrel, you have sort of like a drain, and it's pipes with holes in them so that the water can go through the sand. And then what happens is you've got the gravel on top of those pipes, and that's just covering the pipes. And then you have sand. You put sand all the way up to about 4 inches below the top of the barrel. You have a pipe that comes up from the bottom, and the pressure of the water pushes the water up that pipe. That's about it.
Except for one natural ingredient, bacteria.
When it flows through the sand, it actually gets hooked on the sand and it starts growing and it starts eating. It forms a little ecosystem, just like a wetland, where the bacteria, the good bacteria eat the bad bacteria, basically. And by the time the water gets through to the bottom, it takes out coliform, all coliform, E. coli, fecal coliforms, it'll take it out completely.
Basically, you got to keep water flowing through the sand and make sure the water doesn't freeze. Do that, and your good bacteria stays alive, keeps killing off the bad.
I have one filter that's running since 2007. It's still working.
And that filter is working on more than just bacteria.
I did a test on all of the pollutants that the EPA tests for, and coming out of the slow sand filter, everything that they test for, fluoride, sodium, nitrate, nitrite, silver, arsenic, barium, cadmium, chromium, mercury, lead, selenium. The slow sand filter took that stuff down to about 1/1000th of what the EPA requires, which blew me away because I didn't realize it was that good.
David doesn't drink this stuff, though he'll use it for the shower and cleaning, that type of thing. The well water is safer and better tasting. But he says you could drink this rainwater in a pinch. Spreading the gospel of slow sand filters has been a big part of his blog. He has detailed plans and advice.
There are millions of people in the rest of the world who do not have access to any kind of decent water. And so after reading that, I thought, well, you know what? Why can't we all have this? Why can't everybody have the ability to get water that won't make them sick? And I thought, what should I do?
The blog is pretty basic, runs on donations, and has a pretty sparse HTML. It attracts some anti-government cranks, sure, but he tries to keep it apolitical, and it seems to work for those who really need it. He remembers most everyone that's reached out for help.
I think there was a missionary that contacted. Oh, India. I've had a couple from India. A person from Africa sent me an email, and I sent him the information, but mostly people who are not near any public water supply.
It's obvious how his filters can help the developing world or just folks who want off the grid. David, though, says knowing about water, how it gets pure, how to purify it, that's important knowledge for those of us with perfectly safe tap water as well. He thinks it should be common knowledge, something we know how to do before we need to know how to do it.
It's the way the earth works. It's the way, I mean, we survive on the earth because we have oxygen and we have water. If we have no water, we don't survive.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
We're talking about water and the challenges affecting our water supply. Picture the ocean shore, but underground. There is a line where the fresh water and the salt water meet. It's called the salt line. This salt line moves with the tides. It can move when people take too much fresh water out of the ground. And it's also affected by climate change. As sea levels rise, more seawater rushes into the underground freshwater, which can make the groundwater too salty to drink. Alan Yu has more on how some coastal communities are addressing this problem.
Cape May, New Jersey has a long history as a resort town with seafood, ballrooms, and Victorian-era mansions dating back to the 18th century. It is surrounded by ocean on three sides. But in the 1950s, they started to have a problem with their water supply, which comes from groundwater. Salt water was seeping into their wells, making the water undrinkable. So the city had to abandon its old wells and drill new ones, over and over again. This kept them going for a while, until 1995. Ed Mahoney was mayor at the time.
The New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection asked for a meeting, and they informed me that the potable water supply for the city of Cape May would last 3 years. By the summer of 1998, we would not have enough supply.
The city council went through every idea they could come up with, including one proposal to have ships deliver fresh water to them.
The only alternative that was feasible was number 7, and that was the desal plant, with which none of us were familiar.
Desal, short for desalination, is a process to take the salt out of salt water. The method that Cape May was considering would involve forcing the water through a series of filters at high pressure. They applied for state and federal grants, got New Jersey to issue their first ever environmental permit for a desalination plant, and built it for $5 million. Ed said he and the other council members could not let this fail because the future of Cape May was at stake.
We have tourism today. We wouldn't have tourism. Tourism is 70% of our economy.
We're a living testament that you can make good choices and still provide a high quality and affordable source of water to people.
That's Cape May Water Superintendent Rob Kaminsky, talking over the sound of millions of gallons of water moving through pipes. He showed me around the plant that saved Cape May's fresh water supply. The water comes from 800-foot wells. It is not seawater, it's groundwater that is just too salty to drink. If Cape May were to desalinate seawater, that would mean removing a lot more salt, which would require a lot more energy and thus more money. Using groundwater that's just a little too salty avoids that problem. Pipes take the water to the plant itself, which is inside a historic waterworks building almost a century old. Then a few powerful pumps push the water through white pipes that hold the membranes to filter out the salt.
We have one that's cut in half, but that's basically what it looks like. Maybe a, 30-foot long roll of paper towels encased in a cylinder.
The water goes through more pipes that can add either carbon dioxide or lime if the water is too acidic or alkaline by drinking water standards. And then it's ready to go into taps or one of several water towers. Plant operator Joe Mendo says 70% of the water that goes in comes out as fresh water. The other 30% is concentrated salt water that goes into a nearby creek.
It's like 1/16 of what salt water is that we're putting back out into the environment. So it's really not harmful to the environment.
But they still do regular checks of what comes out. When they first built the plant, they made sure it would not be bad for any animals living in the creek where the salt water goes.
Tested minnows and fiddler crabs, vegetation, and we had to constantly do that for the first 4 or 5 years of the plant.
The plant is due for an upgrade now. the near-century-old building is not quite holding up to the strain of millions of gallons of water going through.
Some of the hurdles we're having is the moisture. It's attacking everything in there, the pipes, the electric. So that'll all be, the electric will be in one room that'll be environmentally protected. So we're looking to really step it up the next plant in the next few years that'll be sustainable for water production for the next 50 plus years.
The problem that led Cape May to build the plant to begin with is going to be more common, especially on the coasts. Allison Lasseter is an assistant professor of city planning at the University of Pennsylvania.
Most towns historically located in places that weren't going to experience saline water. This is starting to change, so the salt line is shifting inland already.
This happens with the tides, but sea level rise and more people living by the coast tapping into fresh groundwater can also shift the line where the fresh water and salt water meet closer inland. One of Allison's research projects is to track this problem along the coast, from Texas to New Jersey. She says places all around the US are now starting to track this problem, and this happens around the world.
So there's individual cities like Jakarta where it's quite well understood that there's seawater intrusion into the city's aquifer, and it's become such an appreciable problem that it's contributing to discussions of relocating the capital.
Cape May solved this problem with desalination. Could the rest of the world just do what Cape May did? Former Cape May Mayor Ed Mahoney thinks there is a lot of potential.
In 1995, desalination would have been the last alternative because of its lack of familiarity to the general public and to governing bodies, and also its expense. Today, I think it has a tremendous uptick.
So does Joaquin Esquivel, chair of the Water Resources Control Board in California.
Removing those salts here is a really important strategy that California has been utilizing, will have to utilize more to make every drop count here in a state that's increasingly obviously stressed by climate change and aridification.
California is going through drought conditions, so one can imagine the appeal of having a drought-proof water supply. Joaquin also referred to aridification, which refers to the climate getting drier in the long term, not just in seasonal drought cycles. California recently considered a desalination plant in Huntington Beach, southeast of Los Angeles and famous for being Surf City, USA. The plant would have provided 50 million gallons of fresh water from seawater. The governor weighed in to support the plant. The California Coastal Commission held a 9-hour-long meeting to decide its fate. No. They Brownsy. Voted no.
No.
Brownsy, no. The vote is unanimous. Okay. All right, the hearing is not over.
So why would California turn down a drought-proof supply of water? This gets to some of the problems with desalination. The proposal for the plant in Huntington Beach is not quite the same as what Cape May did. One, the Huntington Beach plant would use straight-up seawater, not groundwater that's a little too salty for humans to drink. That means there is a lot more salt that has to be filtered out. And the salty water that's left over and has to be dumped is a lot saltier than seawater. It would also come out so fast that it would kill a lot of the animals in the ocean, which the commissioners in California objected to.
So I cannot, in good conscience, say that this amount of damage is okay.
Second, a big issue with desalination of any kind is that it is expensive. It takes a lot of power to run those big pumps to push water through the filters. A widely cited 2019 report from researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, found that this Huntington Beach plant would make water much more expensive, which the commissioners could not accept.
That every human being has the right to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water. The key word here is affordable. And this project simply does not pencil out.
The power needed for desalination creates an additional problem if much of it comes from burning fossil fuels, which makes climate change worse. Also, no local towns had agreed to buy this water. Allison Lasseter, the researcher studying saltwater intrusion, said this could have been a problem later on. She pointed to the case of Brockton, Massachusetts, which pushed through in 2008 to build a desalination plant after a drought.
After the contract was signed, they ran a conservation campaign, and people were able to reduce their water use so much that they didn't actually need the desalination facility any longer. And yet they were locked into an expensive contract afterwards. Desalination is typically the most expensive option relative to all other options. So it's best to exhaust all other types of options before you get to desalination.
One important alternative option that Allison and various other researchers said cities should try first is wastewater recycling. In other words, make better use of the water that right now we flush down a drain. This is not to say desalination is not the future. It clearly is a part of it. Megan Morta is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University. She leads a research group that focuses on desalination. She points out two other smaller plants in California did not face the kind of resistance the failed Huntington Beach plant did. So the vote against that plant is not a vote against desalination overall.
So what I expect to see are a combination of things. I think that we are going to use desalination technologies that were originally designed for seawater desalination to desalinate a whole host of non-traditional waters.
Non-traditional waters like what Cape May did, treating groundwater that's too salty. She says this is something that Southern California definitely needs for the future. The technology behind desalination could also improve. She says the research now focuses on making plants smaller, pairing them with renewable energy, and figuring out better ways to get rid of the extra salty water that remains. Joaquin Esquivel, chair of the Water Resources Control Board in California, says that with climate change, his state is facing an unprecedented challenge when it comes to water access. But at the same time, the potential for better technology makes him hopeful for the future. When I talked to him, he had just been at the opening of a small desalination plant in Menifee, California, not far from Los Angeles.
It's exciting to see because it's this need certainly from the pressures of drought, climate change are driving the innovation that is going to fuel this next generation of projects in the state. What I see is a 21st century approach to our water challenges.
That story was reported by Alan Yu.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about water and the challenges affecting our water supplies. Betsy Damon has worked to bring attention to water issues for more than three decades, and her vehicle is art. She creates public art displays that are meant to engage people with these issues and demonstrate solutions. Nicole Curry talked to Betsy about her long career and the meaning behind her work.
My conversation with Betsy Damon didn't feel like a typical interview. Instead, it reminded me of a moment when everyone gathers around an elder to listen to their many stories and adventures. Betsy is 82 years old. She told me about the first time she noticed water in a new way. It was 1983. She was on a big road trip with her children. They traveled from Yellowstone National Park to the Grand Canyon.
Well, we were traveling across the United States camping. It was gorgeous. And you could camp in so many places and in so many ways. But everywhere we went, the riverbeds, there were dry riverbeds. They remind me of like the stones were like the dinosaur bones you would find in a desert. And the stones were absolutely gorgeous, but carved by water, but everything was baking in the sun.
Betsy was curious about what she saw.
I have to say, I just set out to know water. So I decided to expose people to rivers by casting a dry riverbed in handmade paper.
Betsy and a team of artists got a grant to make a cast of a dry riverbed in Utah. Casting is sort of like that paper mache project you did in grade school, the one where you place wet, mashed up paper into a hollow object. It dries and voila, you have a hard structure in the shape of the void. Betsy applied this technique to the riverbed.
I was just trying to capture the kind of the energy or the shadow of the water that had carved the rocks and carved the river that was no longer there.
Here's how they did it.
We collected various plants that we could make into pulp. And then you bring it back, reconstitute it so that it's very liquidy and you can pour it over the rocks.
She described it like an assembly line. One person was mixing the pulp, somebody else was pouring the mixture into the riverbed, and another was patting it dry to make sure the mixture took form. They worked 8, sometimes 10 hours a day.
And our connection to it became very, really deep. We developed this intimate relationship with the whole site and with the riverbed. And the day that I had looked up at the sky, I'd been on the riverbed for like 10 hours just with the whole situation. And I looked up and there was the Milky Way and it looked just like the riverbed. And I went, oh my gosh. And the next day I learned that the indigenous tribes there call the Milky Way the River of Stones. So that I was just, you know, I was on my way.
The team finished the project in a month. The cast was 250 feet long in the end, so huge it had to be displayed in sections. And it revealed what Betsy had hoped for, the energy of the river. Splotches of red and blue mineral pigments covered the cast. This showed how erosion changed the surface of the rock. There was also dust, grass, and bits of stone stuck in the molding. This showed what materials had collected in the empty riverbed. Betsy named the project A Memory of Clean Water. Her art piece started conversations and jump-started her career as an eco-artist. Betsy started to go to water conferences. She studied the subject and attended community conversations about the topic. She learned how climate change, water pollution, and bottled water impacted natural resources. Betsy even heard conversations about a global water crisis, a phrase used to describe a lack of safe water supply. That's when she decided to try to demonstrate solutions in her artwork. She founded Keepers of the Waters. It's an organization that helps communities restore their local natural water systems. One project required them to clean a pond in Minnesota, and then, in an artistic way, show how it became polluted in the first place.
I wanted to demonstrate how the chemicals that you put on farms poison the water. And when I first went out there, the doctors knew which chemicals were being used by the cancers that showed up.
Betsy wanted to tell the farmers how much the chemicals from their farm had affected the pond.
But you weren't allowed to mention that because you might insult somebody whose family were farmers. And so instead of actually addressing issues like that, which have now become very extreme, you are always told to cover it up. Don't talk about it.
She was frustrated.
I was going to quit my work with water. I was going to quit.
Betsy left the pond project in Minnesota feeling dejected. She was no longer interested in creating any other water-based installations. It seemed to be the end. Until Betsy accidentally dipped her toes back into the subject. In 1989, she was in China with her son, and a stranger told her about an old, run-down water bottling company called God Water. She had to go check it out.
When I drank that water, my entire body came alive, just went alive. Well, haven't you ever felt like a thrill in your body, like when you jump into cold water? I don't know. But this is like interior, like every cell in my body was humming when I drank that water.
And questions began flowing into her mind.
Does water quality matter? Why does it matter? And how does water create life?
Something magical had happened. And at that moment, she remembers saying to herself,
water is the sole source of the living system. Take it away and we don't have it. So how do you bring people into that consciousness? And I went, I can't give up my work. I can't give up my commitment.
It's only natural that water led Betsy back to her work. For the next 20 years, she created public work all over the world, places like Tibet and China. And like she always wanted, her projects called attention to the lack of clean water and viable solutions. Her most significant project to date is an ecological park in China. The public park diverts polluted water from two nearby rivers into a filtration system, which creates clean drinking water. Participants can even see the filtration in action and drink the water. She named it the Living Water Garden. Betsy has collected her life's learnings about water in a new book. It's called Water Talks. And her dear friend and famous biologist Jane Goodall wrote the foreword. But before I ended my conversation with Betsy, I had to ask her an important question. She had spent more than three decades warning people about the water crisis, yet water scarcity is still a concern for many people. I wanted to know what she thought about the future, and did she have any hope?
I'm somewhat confident that we'll, even though we're in an emergency, that we will, in the next 5 years, be full force together, really united. But I also know that the banks and the rich people are buying up the water around the world, and that rich people think they can isolate themselves from this catastrophe just by owning a lot of land. Well, you can't. You can't. In fact, you'll go down with the ship. So embrace all and embrace all life. And then let's do this together. That's my final word.
That story was reported by Nicole Curry. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yub, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Sarah Kirsten is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.